Greetings and obligations, my good and loyal listeners, and welcome to this September 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for this lovely and amazing science podcast, Jim Campanella. The new school year has begun, and at the moment I'm swamped with new work, but I always try to find a few minutes to set aside to report back to all of you fine listeners. I've been collecting new stories of particular interest since August, and I think you'll find them interesting. Okay. First, a couple of responses to emails that I have gotten over the last several months in reference to science stories. Sorry if it's taken me a while to get back to your queries. First, listener John Porter writes asking me why I never cover stories like the newest Mars landing or the discovery of the Higgs boson particle. Why do I always stick to the obscure stories? John, I have a very simple answer to that. Stories like those you mentioned are covered impressively in the common press. In fact, they are probably covered to death given the present invasiveness of the media. Unless I feel there is an aspect of those stories that has been overlooked, misunderstood, or ignored, I usually try to stay away from them since my own input will probably just be redundant. I try to cover topics that may be a bit more obscure but still have a certain wow factor to them. If any listener wants my opinion on a particular science news story of interest to them, then email me in care of the Starship Sofa or campanella@uvulaaudio.com. The second email is from Mark Zanfardino, who wants to clarify a point that I made in a podcast a couple of months ago about quantum teleportation. I mentioned that I had no idea why physicists used the names Alice and Bob as the sender and receiver of a quantum message. Mark informed me that in the science of cryptography, Alice and Bob stand for A and B. Cryptographers started using Alice and Bob because using letters, such as A and B, just became too confusing in explaining various scenarios of sending messages back and forth. Apparently, there are even more names that represent C, D, E, etc. C is Carol, a participant in 3 and 4 party protocols, whatever those are. D is Dave, a participant in 4 party protocols. E is Eve, an eavesdropper. Wow, even with names it sounds complicated. I have a feeling that cryptography may actually get a bit easier with quantum teleportation if it is ever perfected. Thank you, Mark. The third letter of the evening is from Adam Pracht, or Pratched. I'm sorry if I don't get the name pronunciation correct. Adam wrote me a couple of months back. Adam was concerned about the story that I talked about from Popular Science about homebrew molecular biologists who do their genetic tinkering in their garages, basements, and kitchens. Adam felt that I was being very hard on these people who simply love science, and I was being far too negative. Adam, when I read your note, I was of two minds. Yes, you are right. As a scientist who loves science himself and feels that science is very often denigrated in our society as being useful only for getting out the newest model of cell phone, it's great that there are people out there who are so enthused that they want to do science and make a difference. And Adam is right. I should applaud these genetic hackers for wanting to get involved. Adam pointed out that I should have been more constructive and suggested alternatives such as working with the enzyme folding protein game that is available online to suggest different 3D protein structures, or getting actual scientists involved in mentoring gene hacker clubs. And I'll mention another creative alternative in one of the science stories this evening. Adam, I didn't mean to be as hard-boiled as I sounded, but at the same time, it still worries me that common citizens may be putting themselves and others at risk. By the way, you may remember that the story I told you a couple of months back about genetics hacking involved a woman who wanted to make glow-in-the-dark yogurt using green fluorescent protein, GFP. A colleague of mine pointed out that yogurt with bacteria that produce GFP wouldn't glow in the dark unless you ate it under an ultraviolet lamp, that is, a black light. I am not really sure how practical that is. Okay. The actual first story of the night involves one of those constructive alternatives for someone who wants to get involved in hard science but does not necessarily have the background. Crowdsourcing, well, actually crowdfunding, has been around now for several years. Independent filmmakers and artists have used crowdsourced donations to help complete projects that may never otherwise have gotten off the ground. The most famous of these is Kickstarter.com, which has funded a great many well-respected projects over the last couple of years. Well, crowdsourcing has now come to science. A number of science funding websites for the common man have sprung up over the last few months. I'll tell you actually about a couple of these. Microrhiza.com is one, and it connects scientists with donors who can potentially fund their research. This is a Seattle-based company, and they screen proposed projects for feasibility and novelty, and they run checks on applicants to prevent fraud. And once approved, researchers can post videos and a Q&A about their projects on the site. And like Kickstarter, visitors can back the project of their choice. Another of these is SciFund, whose home is the site RocketHub.com, and it's now active in its third round of funding. Besides allowing scientists to get funding for their research work, the SciFund website states, quote, "The SciFund challenge is also a way to get scientists to directly engage with the public. Crowdfunding forces scientists to build public interaction and outreach into their research from day one. It's a new mechanism to couple science and society, and one that we think has a lot of promise," unquote. EurekaFund.org is a third funding site which seems to be mostly interested in small engineering projects that help people. A fourth is SciFlies.org, which has been very successful so far in funding scientists. And finally, there is ScienceDonors.com, which has a website but still has not opened its doors officially for donors to start looking at proposals. Now, all these places pretty much work in the same way. There's a deadline for funding, donors offer money, and if the deadline occurs with the funding goal reached, only then are the donors charged. If the funding goal is not reached in the requisite time, then no one is charged. Donors are lulled into donations by little extras, just like PBS provides. If you donate at a certain level, you'll be named in the acknowledgement of any scientific paper that's published. Or you may get a new species named after you, or your initials in an enzyme name, something like that. It's very difficult to get funding from the USDA, NIH, NSF now, and the current rate of funding for all these science proposals in the United States is about 20%. Crowdsourcing will likely increase that success rate. I mean, I'm certainly considering giving it a try. I mean, I have some cool ideas that may draw in some funding, though probably not cool enough for the government, I suspect. If crowdfunding is not enough for scientists, some astronomers have started crowdsourcing in order to help analyze their data from the sky. Dr. Alyssa Goodman of Harvard University reported a new study in August in the Astronomical Journal about applying crowdsourcing to astronomy. After performing a Yahoo image search for photos of the comet Holmes, which whizzed by the Earth in 2007, Goodman's team used the returned images to reconstruct the comet's orbit in three dimensions, showing that astronomers can take advantage of data provided by an unwitting group of participants. Dr. Dustin Long, collaborator of Goodman, decided to harness the power of picture-posting astro-observers on the web, and he asked an online computer program called Astometry.net to filter through the images. Astometry.net uses the objects in each image, stars for example, to determine where in the sky the image is located. And initially, the Yahoo search returned over 2,400 images to Lang. Of those 2,400 images, there were even things that were not astronomical. Lang said, quote, "There were even two cats in the original search results. That's one in a thousand. I wonder if that's the going rate for images of cats on the web," unquote. Lang used astometry.net to narrow the results to 1,299 usable images. This was a pretty crappy collection of photos snapped in different locations with different cameras and with different exposures. Then the team reconstructed the comet's orbit in three dimensions. The amazing part was that they came very close to the orbit determined by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Lang says, quote, "This is a look at what we could do with really, really heterogeneous data that we really don't know anything about. It was more work than we expected," unquote. Lang's newest project is to assemble an image-based map of the entire sky using only internet-sourced photos. And I wish him luck. I've certainly used sources like that. The concept of data mining, the net, is one that biologists have been doing with genetic data for at least a decade. Now, getting completely off the topic of crowds, let's turn our attention to swarms for just a moment. I don't think that wasps swarm, but I thought that would be a nice lead-in. Here's a short piece of science news from Dr. F. Javier Ortiz Sanchez and his lab, which just published a paper on wasps in the journal Frontier in Zoology this month. Aposematism is a biological term which sounds a lot like it should be taught in a kid's science program, like the wild crats that my children watch, and it should be right up there with migration and camouflage. Unfortunately, it might be a little complex for kids, but it's really kind of cool. Aposematism is actually a defense system that certain animals use against predators. It consists of a toxicity warning using conspicuous coloration. Now, what does that mean? Well, for example, monarch butterflies use it to indicate that they are poisonous to eat. But more nasty animals employ it as well to indicate their nastiness. If the toxin production and aposematic coloration is costly, only individuals in good physical condition can both produce abundant poison and striking coloration. European paper wasps advertise the size of their poison glands to potential predators. Ortiz Sanchez found that the brighter the color, the larger the poison gland. Essentially, the wasp is signaling that it is so strong and so healthy that it can waste energy producing bright color, and a strong and healthy wasp will contain a lot of poison. If you were afraid of wasps before that story, well, then at least now you know which ones to stay farthest away from, the ones that are brightest. The next news story is one that is probably as big as the Mars lander or the Higgs boson, but it's likely that the popular press will completely ignore it because they can't figure out how to make it sexy. For the last decade since the Human Genome Project was completed, I've lectured to my genetics and molecular biology classes that up to 95% of the human genome is junk DNA. It does little or nothing and is primarily made up of repeated sequences or sequences that simply do not code for a protein. Well, for the last several years, the ENCODE project has taken all human genomic DNA and analyzed it in close detail to figure out what exactly is going on in the DNA between genes. ENCODE stands for Encyclopedia of DNA Elements. It involved 440 scientists from 32 labs in the United States, United Kingdom, Spain, Singapore, and Japan. And since 2007, they have collected more than 15 terabytes of raw data that describes places in the genome that contain regulatory binding sites, areas of frequent DNA modification, or roles in managing larger chromatin structure of DNA. And this month, they are publishing at least part of their results in the journal Science. It turns out that so-called junk DNA is anything but. 80% of the genome seems to be regulatory in nature. That means that it functionally controls when, where, and how genes get turned on and off. That means that only about 15% of the genome is actually spacer DNA, junk DNA with little or no function. That's an amazing revelation, and it tells us just how complicated regulation and growth and development may actually be. If it takes 80% of the DNA to control 5%, we are talking about a very complex system here. One of the leading researchers in the ENCODE project, Dr. Eric Green of the National Human Genome Research Institute, said, quote, "For basic researchers, the ENCODE data represent a powerful resource for exploring fundamental questions about how life is encoded in our genome. For more clinically oriented researchers, the ENCODE data provide key information about which genome sequences are functionally important." Unquote. Placement and function of regulatory sites in DNA has been done in individual regions before, but this new map is the most complete picture to date. It provides a launching-off spot for future studies in almost every avenue of genetic research. The maps were created using a variety of molecular genetic techniques to locate binding sites for 119 transcription factors and histones. The experiments were performed in 150 different cell types from different organs and developmental stages. The reason for that is you needed to create a full picture of functionality for all the genes and exactly what they did everywhere. To see how much a previously identified disease-associated variation is located within DNA regulatory elements, Green's team treated hundreds of cell types with nuclease DNase 1. Nucleases digest DNA into bits. DNA sites with high levels of cleavage by DNase 1, called DNase 1 hypersensitive regions, DHS, are known to contain DNA regulatory elements. From this data, they determined the placement of these hypersensitive regions and then aligned them with more than 5,000 gene variants associated with 207 diseases and 447 traits identified in the Human Genome Database. In the Science paper, the team reported that 76% of these disease-associated gene variants fell within hypersensitive regions. The next step is to home in on each variant and determine the exact function of the regulatory region it affects and how it may cause disease. These are major, major breakthroughs in genetics and our understanding of how DNA works to control health. We will see how the popular press handles it, if at all, I suspect, since I have yet to see in any newspaper or on any website that they're not really going to say anything. I'm always a bit stunned when a new piece of science comes out that completely blows away decades of dogma that has been taught. One of those new research papers came out in the journal Nature last month from Dr. Ken Page's lab at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. For years and years, I have taught that every cell in your body has the same genome. That is, there are generally no sequence differences between your heart and lungs and kidney, etc. And for the most part, science has supported that, with things like tumor tissues being an exception. Well, Ken Page has found that there do appear to be sequence differences between organs. Well, all right, not in human bodies, but in plants. But this is still extraordinary because we didn't think that plant DNA sequences differed between tissues any more than humans or animals. Page sequenced the genomes of tissue taken from the entire black cottonwood tree, from their very tip of the crowns to their roots. And what he found was over 100,000 mutations that were unique to a particular tissue sample, differing from other parts of the same tree. Page chose the black cottonwood for the study because it lives up to 200 years and can produce offspring via new shoots that share the same root system as the parent. While clonally reproduced organisms often share a majority of their genes, the researchers found more similarity between the tops of two different trees than between the top and the bottom of the same tree. Mutations that occur in body cells are called somatic mutations. Those are mutations that occur in cells other than sperm or eggs. Those types of mutations are familiar to horticulturists who have long bred new plant varieties by grafting mutant branches onto normal stocks. But until now, no one has cataloged the total number of somatic mutations in an individual plant. Page said, quote, "When people study plants, they'll often take a cutting from a leaf and assume it's representative of the plant's entire genome. That may not be the case. You may need to take multiple tissues to examine." Unquote. Certainly, that's the assumption that I have made for years in my own research work. I assume that every part of the plant was the same genetically. The tissue-specific mutations affected mainly genes involved in cell death, immune responses, metabolism, DNA binding, and cell communication. Page thinks this may be because many of the mutations are harmful, and that the tree reacts by destroying the mutated tissues or altering its metabolic pathways and the way it controls its genes, which leads to further mutations. The findings have paralleled cancer studies. Earlier this year, scientists published in the New England Journal of Medicine a study that showed separate parts of the same tumor can evolve independently and build up distinct genetic mutations, meaning that single biopsies give only a narrow view of the tumor's diversity. In fact, I think I even mentioned that in passing in one of these podcasts months ago. The last story of the night is a very cool one, which I had intended to do anyway, but was suggested also to me by Glenn Schmelzel, one of our listeners. It's scary, but Glenn was able to predict the kind of story that would catch my attention. I mentioned a few months ago in passing that a new extinct human species had been discovered in Russia that seemed to be around at the same time as in Neanderthal. This new species has been dubbed the Denisovans because of where they were found in southern Siberia. Only a piece of a female's finger bone was found to do some basic genetic analysis and sequencing. The researchers could not do more because the ancient DNA was fragmented and degraded. In a major breakthrough in methodology, Dr. Matthias Meyer, researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, wanted to know more about her. So Meyer developed a new sequencing method to produce high-quality genomes, despite the low quality of the DNA extracted from ancient fossils, such as this finger bone. Meyer's work was reported in the journal Science at the end of August. The way that Meyer did his magic was to copy and amplify the DNA molecules so that there were enough of them to study in sequence. Meyer stated, quote, "You have to make many copies so you can read them out," unquote. This is principally pretty difficult for ancient DNA samples, which are often made up of tiny fragments of single-stranded DNA, rather than the long strands of double-stranded DNA that are usually extracted from living samples. To prepare this single-stranded library for sequencing, Meyer attached short artificial DNA adapters to the ends of the fragments to hold them in place during amplification. The amplification process itself was performed using an enzymatic method called PCR. PCR allows you to copy pieces of DNA with a special DNA polymerase enzyme, and you can copy them millions or even billions of times over and over to amplify them. In molecular genetic parlance, a library is a series of DNA fragments that make up a whole genome that have been separately cloned into either viruses or bacteria, and each clone represents one volume of the library of the genome. To me, this all sounds like shades of Jurassic Park. Using DNA left over from the original Denisovan sequencing effort and his new technique, Meyer and his associates sequenced her genome 31 times over, making the results as complete and precise as the genome of any living human person. Meyer said, quote, "What is particularly fascinating is that we're now able to look across the whole genome at all the mutations that have happened since humans separated from Denisovans and their close relatives, the Neanderthals. We can look at a complete catalog of what's happened in this very last step of human history," unquote. The coolest part about Meyer's discoveries is that from the Denisovans, there is a pretty short list of changes during those last steps that Meyer's mentioned in the last couple hundred thousand years. The paper states that some of the changes are in genes related to the wiring of the nervous system, including a couple that have been implicated in autism, and one gene that is regulated by FOXP2, which is involved in speech and language, as well as synaptic plasticity. That's neuronal symplastic plasticity, by the way. For those of you who aren't neurobiologists, what plasticity means is the ability of a brain circuit to be able to be changed easily for learning purposes. I actually mentioned this months ago after the first discovery of the Denisovan, but the researchers learned that Denisovans contributed genes to modern humans, but to varying extents throughout the world. Oddly enough, these ancient ancestors share more genes with people from Papua New Guinea than any other population on Earth studied. In the end, the research found that gene flow from Neanderthals to modern humans was not a single gene flow event from Neanderthals to the ancestors of all non-Africans. That was the original hypothesis based on the partial 2010 first draft of the Denisovan genome. Meyer said, quote, "Something more complicated must have happened. For example, there may have been at least two Neanderthal gene flow events, or a dilution of the initial Neanderthal genetic material in Europe by subsequent expansion of modern humans out of Africa," unquote. Meyers is planning on using his new high-res sequencing technique to sequence more Neanderthal genomes that are very low quality, like the Denisovan girls. The more sequencing of these ancient genomes, the better the picture will get on how modern humans arose and where our final genome eventually came from. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care, stay away from bright-colored insects, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.